Right. It's my turn. The story about how the children of Israel escaped from slavery in Egypt and were brought out by the mighty hand of God to form their own country in Israel is one of the most exciting stories in the Old Testament, one of the most interesting, and also very satisfying, because the good people win out completely and the baddies lose completely. So let me just give a bit of background to remind you of the background to what happens. Starting off with Joseph. Joseph was the great-grandson of Abraham, the son of Jacob, and he was treacherously sold into slavery by his own brothers. He ended up a slave in Egypt, and finally he was thrown in prison for a crime he had not committed. But equally suddenly, he was elevated to the most important position in the kingdom of Egypt when he was able to interpret a dream that Pharaoh had had, which turned out to be a dream prophesying 7 good years of harvest, followed by 7 years of drought and no food at all. And because Joseph was able to interpret the dream that Pharaoh had had, he was given the job of preparing for this disaster. During the 7 years of plenty, they would accumulate grain in stores, which would see them through the bad years. And when the bad years came, Joseph's own family, way back in the land of Canaan, were also affected. It affected the whole region. And he managed to get them down to be with him in the land of Egypt, where he could feed them. And he settled them in a nice fertile area of the Nile Valley. Fast forward 400 years, and the people are still there in the same place. But whereas they'd come down as an extended family or clan of about 40 people, through an incredibly high birthright and presumably very low infant mortality, they'd grown to what some people estimate to be almost 2 million people. And this was a real threat in the eyes of Egypt, because these immigrants, who'd not integrated with Egyptian society, were in danger of taking over. Or that they feared they might take over, especially if in times of war. So Pharaoh started introducing a system of forced labor to try and tire them out and try and reduce the population. That didn't work. So then he introduced an extremely draconian measure. He decreed that the first male baby, that all male babies should be killed at birth, murdered. So the children of Israel were suffering under this tyranny, forced labor and the murder of their male children. Now Moses was one of those babies who should have been murdered at birth, but his mother managed to keep him for a few weeks, hide him, but eventually she could not do it anymore. She put him in a basket, put the basket down by the riverside. Who should find the basket but the daughter of Pharaoh himself? She took pity on him, took him in, and he was brought up in the royal household of Egypt as an Egyptian would be. But when he grew up, he began to identify with his own people. And he ended up in a fight with an Egyptian. The Egyptian was killed, and Moses fled out of the country in order to escape justice. He ended up in a place called Midian. There he got married, started working for his father-in-law. And he was there for about 40 years, just working quietly for his father-in-law. Now, at this point, we are at the end of chapter 2, of the book of Exodus. We're going to be mainly in chapter 3 today, but this right at the end of Exodus chapter 2, verse 23. His own people were still suffering badly back at home. They were still being persecuted with this forced labor regime. Now it came about in the course of those many days that the king of Egypt died, And the sons of Israel sighed because of the bondage, and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their bondage rose up to God. So God heard their groanings, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And God saw the sons of Israel, and God took notice of them. Right, chapter 3. This is where it all starts to happen. Now Moses was pasturing the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of a bush. And he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, and yet the bush was not consumed. It was not burned up. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, "Moses, Moses." And he said, "Here I am." Now this is the first time God has spoken out loud for well over 400 years. The last person to hear the voice of God was Jacob, as had his father Israel and his father Abraham. But God had been silent for a long time. And suddenly he reappears. And then he said, verse 5, "Do not come here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground." He said also, "I am the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob." And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. So God introduces himself to Moses as the God of the patriarchs, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he does that because God had made certain promises to Abraham, which were later repeated to his son and his grandson. Key promises which are about to come into play here. Promise number one, as I'll call it, was that Abraham would have a family which would be growing to an enormous nation. In Genesis 13, chapter 13, verse 16, he says that God said to Abraham, "I will make your descendant as the dust of the earth, so that if anyone can number the dust of the earth, then your descendants can also be numbered." So this, imagine a handful of dust, trying to count each individual particle, it's impossible. So it gives an idea of the enormity of this, of the population that Abraham would father. And then in Genesis 22, verse 17, God comes up with two other images for explaining the size of this Israelite population. "In blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven and as the sand which is on the seashore." So poetic descriptions there of the number of Jews. Now that's promise number one. Promise number two is to be found in Genesis 17, verse 8, and in other places as well. "And God said to Abraham, I will give to you and to your descendants after you the land of your sojournings, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God." So Abraham settled in the land of Canaan, but he was a nomad. He moved around with his flocks from place to place, living in tents. What God was promising here was that they would actually possess the land and set up their own country there. So, since the time of Joseph, promise number one had been moving along very nicely. The population had expanded gigantically and was indeed coming true. But there'd been no progress at all with promise number two. And this is the issue which God is now about to address, giving them possession of the land of Canaan. But before we go on to that, he then goes on to, where are we? Right, so back in verse 6, "For he said also, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at the Lord." And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters, for I am aware of their sufferings. So I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanite and all the otherites. And now, behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Right. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh, so that you may bring my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. So Moses is here being commissioned to act as God's agent in this deliverance of his people from Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? Fair enough. He's been out of the country 40 years. He's got no credibility with his own people and zero credibility with Pharaoh. So what chance have I got? God's reply to this is, certainly I will be with you, and this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Okay, well, that's in the future. Then Moses said to God, behold, I am going to the sons of Israel, and I shall say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you. Now they may say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? So Moses is asking God for a name. God's had names. All the Egyptian gods, of which there were dozens, had names. So Moses felt he needed to produce a name. And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am, in capital letters, has sent me to you. Well, that's an odd reply. I am. We all probably say I am, or the contracted form I'm, several times a day. I'm hungry. I'm tired. Where are you? I'm upstairs. I'm an accountant. So the verb to be, of which am is a part, is called a link verb. It links two things. It links the subject, I, and the thing that you are, an accountant. I am an accountant. Fred is a bricklayer. George was upstairs. Three parts with the link in the middle. So when God says, I am, but nothing there, nothing to link, he's not using the verb to be in its normal function as a link verb, because there's nothing, there is no what is called a subject complement at the end, on this side. He's using the verb to be in a way that really only God can use it. And what he's saying is, I am being itself. I am existence. I am the very essence of existence. Which is a revelation that had not been made previously to the human being. I read somewhere that this is a good quote. This name is a declaration of independent, self-determining existence. God is self-existent, self-sufficient, and self-sustaining. That's a nice definition of God, of the I am side of God. But then, verse 14, God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Now I'm going to change Bible versions. I'm going to move away from my normal New American Standard and use the American Standard Version of 1901. And that reads here, and God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, Jehovah, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever. This is my memorial name to all generations. Now, most of you will be reading Bibles where it doesn't say Jehovah, it says the Lord. And I'm going to explain how this comes about in a minute. Right. So, Chris, perhaps you could turn on that number, first OHP. I think if you turn the red knob, you might be able to make it a bit bigger. The red knob up there, the side there. All right. Okay, that's all right. That's good, excellent. Right, this is some Hebrew. That name, Jehovah, consists of just four letters. It's the big red word there. Just four letters in Hebrew. Hebrew goes in the direction of the red arrow, the opposite direction to English, from right to left. And the four letters are Yod, He, Vav, He. Next line down, the nearest English equivalent letters to those four Hebrew letters are Y or J, H, V or double V, or double U as we say, H. Moving down to the blue arrow, we turn that round to our English direction, Y or J, H, V or double V, H. And inserting some vowels between those four consonants, we end up with these four possibilities: Jehovah, Yehovah, Yahweh, Yahweh. Those are thought to be the most likely possibilities. Now, why we've got four possible pronunciations of this word? Why every other word in Hebrew we know how to pronounce, but not this word? And the reason for that is that several centuries after what we're looking at now, once the Temple of Solomon was going and they were doing the sacrifices and observing the feasts, the Jews decided that this name of God, which had been revealed to Moses, was too sacred a thing to be pronounced on the lips of evil men. It was too holy, and it should never actually be spoken out. So although it remained in the written text, they started substituting one of the green words, Adonai, which means my Lord, or in more modern times, Hashem, which means the name, the Shem name. Okay. So, can you move on to the second one now, Chris? Which goes crossways. And maybe we've got some trouble getting all this in, unfortunately. But this is an example how this, what I've just explained to you, works out in practice. Oh, I've got most of it in. Deuteronomy 6, chapter 4. A key verse in Judaism. Oh, I should have said that the practice of not saying the name save of God and substituting Adonai continues to this very day. In a synagogue service, there is always a reading from the Torah, the five books of Moses, and the reader, when he gets to a Yahweh word, says Adonai, even though he's reading Jehovah in the text. So Deuteronomy 6:4, Hear, O Lord, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. Or in the American Standard Version, 1901, that becomes, Hear, O Israel, Jehovah our God is one, Jehovah. Slightly different translation there, but back to Jehovah. Now, this is how it goes in Hebrew, and the two in the direction of the red arrow. The two red words highlighted are the two Jehovah names, Yod-Heh, Vav-Heh. So our reader will say, Shema Yisrael, Adonai Eloheinu, Adonai Echad. Okay, got that picture? Right, I think I've finished with all that now. Chris, you're on holiday for the rest of the morning. Now, we now come to translations of the Bible into other languages. The first one was into Greek about 250 years before Christ, for the benefit of Jews who'd lost their Hebrew and were living in Greek-speaking areas. And there, when the translators used, I've now forgotten the Greek word, Kyrios. Now I use Kyrios in place of the name of God. Kyrios means Greek for Lord or Master. So now we've moved one stage further away from the original text. Now the written text itself includes the Lord in English rather than Jehovah. So Jehovah is now disappeared from sight in this Greek translation. Next big one was into Latin in about 400 years after the birth of Christ. Same story, they used Dominus, which means Lord or Master, in place of Jehovah. Coming now forward to the time of the years leading up to the Reformation itself, the scriptures were translated into European languages. Into English, in the 1300s and 1400s, they started to use the Lord. But then along came Tyndale. Thank you very much. William Tyndale. Torah translation appeared in 1530, and he revived Jehovah. So, and this is a very influential translation. So English people in the years of the Reformation were using Jehovah for the name of God for the first time for many, many hundreds of years. But his reform didn't stick. When the authorized King James Version was published in 1611, using large chunks of Tyndale's translation, they reverted to the Lord. And the Lord, and that's been such an influential translation that really the Lord was used then on right up until the end of the 19th century, the Lord. Over on the continent, the Germans, first of all, there was a very influential translation by Luther, and he used for the name of God Der Herr, H-E-R-R, which means German for Lord or Master, or now simply Mr. Der Herr. The French went for a rather idiosyncratic solution. They substituted for the name of God the Eternal One. He's called L'Eternel. So, Psalm 23, the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. L'Eternel est mon berger, berger being shepherd. Je ne manquerai de rien. The Spanish, on the other hand, favored Jehovah. And Spanish Bibles today and have always used Jehovah, which they pronounce Jehovah. So it's the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Jehovah es mi pastor, pastor meaning shepherd, nada me faltará. We should remember that Spanish is not just the language of Spain, it's the language of most of South America, Central America, Mexico, and quite large chunks of the United States. Half a billion people, billion with a B, have Spanish as their first language. And those among them who are Bible readers will use Jehovah as their name of God to this day. Right, 1901 we come down to, another attempt to revive Jehovah in English. This was the Americans. They were producing a revision of the King James Version, which was very out of date as far as its language went. Thou wilt, he thoughteth, and all sorts of things like that. They wanted to get rid of that. But at the same time, they decided to have another go at reintroducing Jehovah as the name of God. And in their preface to their translation, the American revisers say this. The change which substitute Jehovah for Lord is one which will be unwelcome to many. They know that you're a conservative lot. You don't like change. You've used the Lord. Your fathers used the Lord. Your grandparents, your great-grandparents. Why should we have to change now? But they push ahead because they think it's the right thing to do. And this is what they say. The American revisers, after a careful consideration, were brought to the unanimous conviction that a Jewish superstition, that is not politically correct, that a Jewish superstition which regarded the divine name as too sacred to be uttered ought no longer to dominate in the English or any other version of the Old Testament. This memorial name, explained in Exodus chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, which we just read, and is emphasized as such over and over again in the original text of the Old Testament, designates God as the personal God, as the covenant God, the God of revelation, the deliverer, the friend of the people. Not merely the abstractly eternal one of French translations, so they don't like l'éternel any more than they like the Lord, but the ever-living helper of those who are in trouble. This personal name, with its wealth of sacred associations, is now restored to the place in the sacred text to which it has an unquestionable claim. So that's a very passionate plea for the restoration of Jehovah. Once again, it didn't stick. Their model was not followed. Later translations into English in America and Britain and the English-speaking world continue to use the Lord as they do today. So the reason for going into all that is because as you read your Bibles, using the Lord, and you read this verse 15, first 14 and 15, and God said to Moses, I am who I am, and he said, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. And God furthermore said to Moses, thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, the Lord, the God of your fathers, blah, blah, blah. You don't make the connection between the Lord there and I am who I am here, partly because we're working in translation, because this, the I am notion, is included in the name Jehovah. Jehovah is also derived from, I should have said that earlier, is derived from the verb to be. So when he says his name is Jehovah, this is the name which he chose for himself. He is repeating the I am points that he'd made earlier. And that is something which is worth knowing and can easily be missed. Okay. Right, God now goes on to give more details to Moses about what he wants him to do. Verse 16. Go and gather the elders of Israel together and say to them, the Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me, saying, I am indeed concerned about you and what has been done to you in Egypt. So I said, I will bring you up out of affliction in the land of Canaan, out of the land of affliction of the land of the Canaanite and the otherites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. And they will pay heed to what you say, and you with the elders of Israel will come to the king of Egypt, and you will say to them, Jehovah, the God of the Hebrews, has met with us. So now please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to Jehovah our God. But I know, verse 19, that the king of Egypt will not permit you to go except under compulsion. So I will stretch out my hand and strike Egypt with all my miracles, which I shall do in the midst of it. And after that, he will let you go. So God intends to be entirely in control of this process. He's telling Moses to go and arrange some interviews with Pharaoh, make demands on behalf of his people. But God knows that Pharaoh will not agree. And he knows because God himself has hardened Pharaoh's heart not to agree. God is completely controlling the situation. Moses and Pharaoh are almost sort of puppets in his hand as the situation develops. Okay. So, a series of meetings are about to take place in which Moses confronts Pharaoh, tells him that Jehovah wants them to release them, and Jehovah says no. Now, if we look at Moses, we see quite clearly that he is the agent of God in this whole process. God has commissioned him, God has told him what to do and what to say, and he does it. If we look at Pharaoh, his actions were motivated by the interests of the Egyptian state. This immigrant population were getting too big. They presented a danger. He needed to do something about it. Murdering babies, why not? But he also needed the slave labor population. They were an important part of the Egyptian economy. It was to have all these people working and producing bricks. So Pharaoh was acting in the interest of the Egyptian state in killing babies and in not releasing his slave labor force. But if you look a bit deeper, you realize that Pharaoh was actually opposing what I earlier called promise number one and promise number two of God. God's promise to Abraham was that he would immensely increase the population. Pharaoh's response is to murder babies. They are coming directly against it. God's promise was that he would give these people their own land in the land of Canaan. Pharaoh is coming against this. In these encounters, Pharaoh is Satan's man, just as much as Moses is God's man. Satan seeks to oppose the will of God, particularly in his redemptive purposes. And remember, this liberation of the slaves of Egypt was stage one in a long series of events which would eventually lead to the coming of our Messiah, Jesus Christ, from this very family. And Satan sought to oppose this right through. Remember the story of Esther, where they tried to wipe out all the Jews. That would have effectively stopped God's purposes from being fulfilled in the coming of the Messiah. And there are others. So, and also, thinking about it, if you're set on getting rich and famous, wealthy and having influence, you often end up in the arms of Satan because he is able to give you these things. We know that from the New Testament, where Satan promised to Jesus, I will give you all these kingdoms. They are mine to give you. And people who end up in positions of power and influence in the world have often got Satan's help on the way. And one of the best ways to do that is through occult religion, child sacrifice, child abuse, and Pharaoh was into occult religion in a big way. His magicians were able to perform the most astounding miracles, which are unequaled anywhere in the scriptures, like bringing plagues of this and plagues of that on the whole country. This is absolutely outstanding power, which they derive directly from their occult encounters with Satan himself. So here we have a very straightforward good versus evil, God versus Satan conflict. Okay, well, just summarizing what we've seen today. God introduces himself to Moses as the covenant-keeping God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God had promised to multiply his descendants like the stars of heaven, promise number one, and promise number two, he promised to give them the land of Canaan for an everlasting possession. God identifies himself to Moses as the I Am, the self-existent, self-sufficient, self-sustaining God. God then reveals to Moses his personal name, which is based on this I Am concept, which is Jehovah or Yahweh. The current favorite among scholars is Yahweh. Jehovah is thought to be an unlikely pronunciation nowadays. Later generations of Jews and Christians have abandoned this name in favor of surrogates like Adonai, the Lord, or Der Herr. A surrogate is one thing which replaces another thing. Margarine is a surrogate for butter. They used to tell you that margarine tastes just as good as butter, and it's actually better for you. Neither of these things is true. So, Adonai, the Lord, Der Herr, us are the surrogate names which we generally use for Yahweh. God commissions Moses to act as his agent in liberating the children of Israel from bondage in Egypt and getting them on the road towards the land of Canaan. Satan is the unseen power behind Pharaoh and his magicians. Pharaoh is the first in a long line of satanic political leaders who seek to destroy God's chosen people, including Haman in the book of Esther, King Herod. If you remember, he's introduced a baby murder scheme in order to try and kill Jesus. Adolf Hitler, the Islamic Republic of Iran, whose declared intention is to wipe Israel off the map, directly in conflict with the promise to Abraham, can you see? These people are always acting head-on conflict with what God has said. And finally, the Antichrist himself. Let me just finish with reading a very well-known scripture from Ephesians, chapter 6, verse 12. For our struggle is not against flesh and blood, but against the rulers, against the powers, against the world forces of this darkness, against the spiritual forces of wickedness in the heavenly places. Okay.